welcome to episode 90 of Up and In, the Baseball Prospectus podcast in DeKalb, which is in Illinois. I'm Kevin Goldstein in Brooklyn, which is in New York. He's Jason Parks. Jason, say hello to the internet.
It is in New York. Good call. Howdy.
We have a good show for you tonight. We have an intimate show because I realized this morning that I forgot to book a guest. I had some people I wanted to invite, and I'll invite them for next week. And real quick, big thanks to Jim Callis, who saw me bitch about it and then like sent me a private message saying, I'm available whenever you need me. And I know when Jim's on, it's very popular, and it's not that we don't have Jim on. I just don't want to burn all my Jim Callis bullets, and we're certainly going to have him on around draft time. So I'd want to have him on now and then do it again in 6 weeks. So you'll hear Jim again, and thanks to Jim, who's always very, very nice to the show and a close friend and somebody who's been very important to me in my career. But so we're going to go guest-free. It's going to be an intimate show, Jason.
Yeah, short, intimate show. That's fine.
We'll do the emails as always, and you came through again. Great emails. We'll talk a little bit about baseball. We're going to talk briefly about Pudge Rodriguez retiring and what a wonderful and unique player he was, both on a performance and a scouting level. We'll talk a little bit about big league baseball and play the Is It Real game with some teams that have much better records than you might have expected after 2 weeks. We'll talk about something I wrote and something I've been thinking about a lot, even though it's incredibly early in the season, even though we're 2 weeks into the season. I want to talk about the 2011 draft from a pitching context, and does this have a chance to be the best draft for pitching ever? And then, of course, Jason spent most of his week, as you heard last week, on a scouting trip. He was in Wilmington, Delaware, watching the Wilmington Blue Rocks, the high A affiliate of the Kansas City Royals, play a few teams, and we'll talk about some of the players that he saw. And then we'll take a break. There'll be no guests. We'll just do the goofy stuff. Talk about our musical guest, the return of Screaming Females. Do a What Are You Drinking? A quick pop culture moment. I want to talk about a video game that you might not think you'd like, but I think if you're one of the stats crazy kids out there, you'd really like this game because there's an incredible statistical and math component to it. It's called Disgaea. And then we'll talk about what we're doing, and we'll be done, and then show will be over. Jason will say goodbye. You'll all cry, and you'll wait for next week. Time for housekeeping, Jason.
Let's do it.
If you want to email us, keep the emails coming, podcast@baseballprospectus.com. If you want to follow us on Twitter, I'm at Kevin_Goldstein. Do not ask me when Anthony Rizzo is coming up. Jesus, people. Get over it. Calm the shit down. And if you want to follow Jason, and he won't tweet stuff like that. He'll be nice and calm and strange. Professor Parks is where you'll find him. We have a Facebook page. Go to Facebook. You look for Up and In, and you somehow find it. And we open up the velvet rope and let you in. It's a nice community of people talking about all sorts of stuff. And if you're one of the people who listens to us on iTunes, you can rate us and review us, and it does help us a bit. And we appreciate it when you do. It's time for the emails, Jason.
All right.
First email is one of my favorite emails we've ever gotten that is not a funny and bizarre email. This might be my favorite baseball-related email we've gotten in show history, Jason.
Really?
It comes from Patrick, and Patrick is in Dallas. And Patrick writes, I tweeted you earlier in the day about which players to watch in the Angels AA team. I thanked you for your answer. I said I'd email you a question about a scout I was sitting near. It turns out, however, that I worked up enough courage to ask the scout if I could sit next to him and ask a few questions. The scout said yes. So I started with some times I got for Segura from home to first. The conversation started out slow as I didn't want to distract the scout, and as the game went on, he was more open to my questions and just started talking. Sometimes to me, sometimes to the twin scout across the aisle, and sometimes he addressed anybody within earshot. Whether asking questions or just listening to the scouts talk amongst themselves, I learned a lot. At times, the scouts would even ask me questions to get me to think critically about the at-bat. To say this was fucking awesome would be an understatement. On more than one occasion, both you and Jason highly recommended sitting near a scout, and I can say that scouts hold a fascinating conversation with a complete stranger. The one thing that... first of all, that's totally cool. And I don't know who the scout is, but you found the coolest scout ever. Because that's a pretty remarkable opener for you. But Patrick goes on. The one thing that really struck me about the scout was his brutal honesty. If he thought a pitch was a piece of shit, that's what he would call it. During the middle innings, there was some poorly executed relief pitching, and the scout's interjections made him seem almost insulted that he had to watch such bad baseball. At one point, the scout was comparing, for me, the pitcher's approach to the last two hitters, a lefty, then a righty. He then talked about the types and the sequences of pitchers. I asked the scout if the on-deck hitter was thinking the same thing, and he responded, "Fuck no." Are most scouts this honest when talking about players? This is not to say the scout is mean. He certainly realizes that you can't talk to players this way, but his evaluations left little room for the misunderstanding of his opinion. Thanks again for encouraging your listeners to bend the ear of a scout. This was by far the best baseball game I'd ever been to, Patrick in Dallas. That's a great email, Jason.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good email. I mean, that's not the best email.
On a
that's,
baseball
the, that's your level, favorite email?
On a baseball level, that's my favorite email, but I want to answer Patrick's question. You know,
it's a good email.
We talked about the email we got where someone asked, you know, do you guys like it when someone just pops out of nowhere and you see something? We said, that's what we live for. One of the reasons I'm into this world and one of the reasons I like this so much is because scouts are like that, because scouts are, to use your term, brutally honest, because there's no room to be nice. These people are evaluating talent for the future of baseball. This is why I like the scouting world, because there's no bullshit. There's no fandom. There's no go team stuff. There's no niceties to try to, you know, revolve around what you're really thinking, because there's no room for that in scouting. It's just blunt, direct, cut to the chase. Here's what this player is. That's what I love about it. That's another thing that I just love about the game and love about the scouting world, which is there's just no bullshit involved. If the guy can't hit, you're going to go, yeah, he can't hit. You're not going to go, well, you know, he's got some stuff. If he figures things out, you're going to go, no, I don't think he can hit.
Right. I mean, it needs to be said, too, though, I think that, you know, it looks like Patrick hit on a really good scout. Like, he hit on somebody that their personalities came together pretty well, that he was brutally honest like this. But, you know, just like any profession, you know, not everybody's created equal. There are scouts who aren't very personable, who may not be as good as other scouts, who may not have opinions that are as good as other scouts, and certainly won't be as brutally honest as other scouts. I mean, it just depends on the person.
Yeah.
You know, and when you hit on one like Patrick hit on one, that's a big score because – you know, you get a guy who's really super knowledgeable, who's brutally honest, and who's willing to talk. That is when you are in the classroom.
Yeah.
You are in the eye of the classroom.
Yeah. I mentioned last week there was just one scout at the King County Beloit game I went to, and he wanted nothing to do with me. And that's cool. That's totally fine. There's many kinds out there.
Yeah.
Our next email comes from John, and this is another interesting question. John writes, last week's discussion on results-based irrational exuberance for prospects sparked a thought. Does the level of umpiring in the minors match roughly with the level of talent on the field? Are the minors as much a training ground for young umps as they are for young players? And if they are, couldn't this have an impact on some players more than others? I'm thinking about a pitcher with plus movement on breaking balls not getting or maybe getting calls on pitches that a major league ump might give, encouraging a prospect not to throw it. And on the other side, hitters with good plate discipline might get more of those calls than they will later. Maybe this would explain the great numbers posted by Archimedes Pozo that made us all fall in love with him. John, this is a great question. The answer is absolutely yes. And not enough people understand that. I'm glad you brought it up. Umpires are just like the players in the minor leagues. The umpires are minor league umpires, and they are graded by the managers of the league during the season, and they are trying to earn a promotion to the next level, and then and they're hoping to move up the ladder and eventually obviously become big league umpires. They're minor leaguers just like the players, and they're bad just like the players,
mm-hmm.
or at least eons away from the big leagues. But I'm glad you brought the pitchers and the hitters because it's totally true. I'll give you a great example, and you can go look up his numbers somewhere. Clayton Kershaw, when he was in the Midwest League, had awesome numbers, and umpires had no idea how to call his curveball. Not a clue in the world. They missed it all the time. He threw it for strikes so often and had it called a ball, it was pathetic, and you could see him get frustrated about it because they couldn't call the curveball yet. And, you know, I remember like a guy like Connor Crumless, who led the Myers in walks here, and I remember someone saying to me, he's got a way better understanding of the strike zone than any of the umpires in this league. And so you do see it. And there are players who, because of what they do, they're affected by it at the lower levels. Their stuff actually, not their stuff, but their game actually kind of almost improves because the umpires get better.
Well, and I actually like it from a developmental point of view, you know, when behind the plate, you're going to get squeezed a lot, or, you know, in the case of Kershaw, somebody who, you know, your pitch has so much bend to it, and the umps can't really recognize it, that it crosses the plate at a certain point. I think it kind of, in a way, it helps you, refine, it helps your command become, you know, even sharper when you're not getting the calls, when you're not, you know, getting the spots. I mean, it's a stretch, but at the same time, I mean, they're developing while the players are developing, so it's got to converge at some point, you know, and if you can both grow from it, if you can both learn from it, then it's a good thing. You know, it's all part of the developmental process.
Yeah, and so, yeah, there's some, you'll see some really bad umpiring in the minors. It's a tough gig, and they're getting paid like garbage and trying to work their way up.
Complex league umpiring is funny. It's really funny to watch. It's like they don't exist. It's just whatever. Just okay, that's a ball. Makes sense. I didn't see it.
Our next email comes from Josh, and Josh says, KG and the professor, my name is Joshua, and I am from Alma, Arkansas. You ever been to Alma, Arkansas, Jason?
No, I haven't. Oh, I don't know.
And Josh goes on.
I don't think so.
I love the show and everything the two of you write. Everything? I don't even love everything I write. As an English major in school, I really appreciate the professor's works like the Spring Training Diaries. It combines my two passions, baseball and literature. I think they are outstanding. That's because they are, Josh.
Thank you, Josh. Thank you, Kevin.
And Josh says, my question is about minor league players who are determined to be non-prospects or at best barely on the radar. You said in the past that not much was thought of Ian Kinsler early on, and I am supposing the same could be said of other major leaguers, like maybe Ryan Ludwig, for instance. Actually, Ryan Ludwig was considered a very good prospect and kind of a bust. But how does a player go from non-prospect status to someone a club is willing to give a chance to in the major leagues? On the management level, I would think the player would have to overcome the bias of scouts and organizations who thought the player was going to amount to nothing more than a placeholder. On a player level, my guess is they would be late bloomers and dramatically increase their physical abilities or maturity at the age of 23 or so. Or a light bulb would click and they suddenly showed marked improvements in pitch recognition and plate discipline. Maybe it's just dumb luck and a player is called up to replace an injured major leaguer and performs way beyond expectations, so he sticks. Do you have stories for this happening for a player in the past? Thanks, Josh. Well, let's talk about Ian Kinsler. Ian Kinsler was
That's a good email. That's a really good email.
Yeah, Ian Kinsler was a very late draft pick out of the University of Missouri. He was just kind of an okay college player. Looked like he'd be just okay. And Ian Kinsler, from the second he got to the minors, killed it. Just killed it. And it always takes a while. I mean, Ian Kinsler flirted with 400 much of his time in the Midwest League playing
for Clinton. Right.
And people were like, well, it's a, you know, yeah, he looks good. No question he looks good. We're still talking about a guy who was drafted late, who's kind of a college performer, older for the league. Let's wait and see. And then he moved up and he killed it. And he moved up and he killed it. And you get to the point where you're like, look, this guy's really pretty good. And so that's a quick one. And the thing is, Kinsler never has anything to recover from. Kinsler never got off to a bad start. Like, he crushed it from day one. You can contrast that with a guy like Brian LeHair, who, you know, late round pick, just had some good seasons, some okay seasons, some bad seasons, some decent numbers in the Cal League. You know, he's at AAA, putting up good numbers, but not really good enough for your first base prospect. And then he started putting up crazy numbers, and it took forever, but scouts came around on him. Yeah, you could talk to scouts last year, they go, you know, I know LeHair's 28 years old, but that guy could play first base every day in the big leagues. Not be a star, but play first base every day in the big leagues. And he's doing it right now, and I think he can, you know, in kind of a – he's kind of our generation's Brian Daubach or something. But, you know, so these guys do happen. And, you know, the thing is, more often than not, I got to tell you, I actually do believe that for the most part, we can talk about guys getting screwed and guys getting left behind and first-round picks getting too many chances and all that kind of stuff. I still think for the most part, baseball is very much a meritocracy.
Right. Well, I mean, back to the bias point, I mean, and I think I've mentioned this on here before, but, you know, I got to witness it kind of, and I'm not accusing, but, you know, like Mitch Moreland was a Ranger who was drafted.
That's a great, you know, perfect, yes.
Out of college. I mean, he had a lot of power. This was like a kind of a beefy college.
And they drafted him hoping he'd be willing to become a reliever.
That's the thing. And so after he goes and you're like, okay, he's hitting, he goes to the Midwest League and he crushes. In the Fall Instructional League of 08, he was working as a reliever, you know, and so obviously at that point, the Rangers didn't seem to believe in the bat, or at least they thought that his arm would play better. You know, he might be able to contribute at some point down the line as a reliever. He had a low 90s fastball and a pretty good slider. I saw him in action. The next year, you know, he's still hitting, and he crushes, and he keeps crushing all the way up the chain. I don't know when it happened, but at some point the Rangers had to start believing in him. But it didn't happen early on. In fact, it didn't happen for a while.
It took a while, yeah. And
You know?
you know, the thing was, is after you know that instruct when you talked about the Rangers were going to move him to the bullpen, and Moreland asked them, said, "Can I get one more year? Can I get one
Right.
year hitting? And if it doesn't work, I'll move to the bullpen." The Rangers said, "Yeah, because why? You know, let's
Why not?
why make him a pitcher when he doesn't want to be one? If in a
Right.
year he says if it doesn't work out, he's willing to be one. Yeah, go ahead." And obviously the rest is history. But that's a great one.
Yeah, because you know, it took a long time for people, including scouts. I mean, I didn't talk to a scout that thought he was going to be to reach the majors until you know the year he reached the majors.
Right, but they did come around. Like, you know what, he can hit. He can
he
really
can hit.
All he does is hit.
It's funny. It's funny when that happens. That's it. I really like that email.
Next email is from Seth. Seth's in Vancouver, Washington, where they have hockey riots. And Seth writes, "I was reading a recent magazine article regarding the use of biomechanics to evaluate pitcher deliveries. It compared the near-perfect delivery of Greg Maddux to the near-disaster delivery of Steven Strasburg. This got me thinking, do front offices take biomechanics into consideration when trading away or for a pitcher? What about when signing a pitcher to a new contract or an extension? How do pitcher mechanics affect the way he is viewed by a scout? I love the podcast. Keep up the good work, Seth." Seth, biomechanics are very important, but they are not the pill to fix everything. They are not the answer to all that ills pitchers when it comes to so many of them getting hurt. And, you know, if that article was written 6 years ago, it would compare the near-perfect delivery of Mark Pryor. How'd that turn out? You know, and you could say against the near-disaster delivery of Felix Hernandez.
Right.
How's that worked out? He's been fine. You know, we can talk about that stuff, and scouts certainly look at deliveries, and they look at effort, and they look at the elbows and shoulders, and you make sure things work right, and they're fluid, and they're smooth, and things are easy, basically. And that goes into your scouting report, but you don't totally kill a guy or totally support a guy if he's a good or bad delivery, because there's a certain point where we just don't know. Felix Hernandez has been totally fine, and he's got
right.
And he's a workhorse. There was a ton of innings, and he's got an ugly, violent delivery that you would never want anyone to learn. Mark Pryor had a perfect delivery, according to every human alive. And I'm sure someone will show me as an inverted W with some animated GIF now. But, you know, and he destroyed himself. His career got destroyed by shoulder issues. So it matters, but the key to remember is it does not always matter.
Well, right. And about the inverted W, the scap loading or whatever, you know, Nolan Ryan did that. Power pitchers tend to do that. And
How'd Ryan work out?
he worked out pretty well. My problem with the biomechanics is just that sometimes, and not all the time, they fail to appreciate the fact that every pitcher is unique, like you're describing, and the approach is very, very academic. And it's not often, you know, when you look at the actual execution, you know, that's when, you know, when a scout's looking at a pitcher, he is going to make note of the mechanics. Some he might, you know, write down that he doesn't think that it's sustainable because of this and this and this, and he may be right and he may be wrong, but he's going to make note of it. But he's also going to make note of what's happening, you know, the utility of everything, what's happening now, what he thinks is going to happen in the future as far as like the stuff and whatnot. A lot of the biomechanics stuff, it just looks at this in a very academic, through a very academic lens, and I think it sometimes it can be a little short-sighted and very binary in scope.
Right. There's always supposed to be some sort of violence or some sort of balance, because you know, if I showed you some guy and whatever the biomechanic little ball said, oh, this guy's got a beautiful delivery, and he was 88 to 89 miles an hour, and it said, oh, this guy's got a horrible delivery, and he's 99, I'll want the 99 guy. You know? I don't care about the other guy.
Right.
You know? And so we got...
Oh, right on.
He's got a great delivery. That's great. What comes out of his hand?
88.
That's what matters.
I'll take the guy who throws 100. I don't care if he breaks in 2 years. I'm going to love those 2 years.
Right. I mean, I don't care if after every start he's got blood coming out of the shoulder part of his jersey. I mean, I'm interested in that guy.
Sure. Velocity is awesome.
Our next email comes from Chris B. Chris B is in Delta, BC. That's British Columbia, Dave.
Yeah,
Back to
sure.
back Canadian emails. People say we hate Canada. We read their emails. Chris says, KG and the professor love the show, most of the musical guests, and especially the goofy stuff. We play a lot of diverse music. We can't, you know, I don't, there's no way you can like all the musical guests unless you're one of those people who goes, I like all music, and I hate those people. But, you know, we did get an email, Jason. I'm going to go on a side here real quick.
Okay.
We got an email complaining about the lack of hip hop and rap on the show.
Did I send that in?
No, you did not, unless you used a pseudonym. And
okay.
And that person's right. And I just don't know any bands or people in that world. And so if you know bands who are doing hip hop music and you want to get them on the show, have them get in touch with me because I would love to play more hip hop music on the show. But Chris B from Delta, British Columbia, a hip hop center, writes, my question deals with Archie Bradley. If his agent approached you right now and offered you a now or never Archie Bradley 10-year contract worth $10 million, do you accept this deal? If you do, at what point does the money become too much for the risk, or does the potential long-term security of a potentially amazing pitcher make it worth more than that $10 million? Thanks, Chris B.
Delta
on the team? BC. Oh, my God. If I was the team, I'd say, where's the contract? Give it to me before you stop drinking.
I'd sign it out with my own blood. You know? Come on.
I mean, you got to remember, Chris B. in Delta BC, that and then Gerardo Concepcion, who's, you know, a young prospect with like a 4 or 5 upside from Cuba on the international free agent market, just got $8 million. If he's worth eight, I mean, if you threw Archie Bradley as a free agent right now, I don't know, 20, 25? Somewhere around there? $10 million,
I mean,
would be a bargain.
Think about it. He's going to move fast. That means he could be in the majors in a couple of years, and then, you know, he would already – that's actually
– Then you get it's
you
8 years,
four,
eight
you
years
two,
for 8 mil? Jesus.
Right. Then you get 8 years for $10 million.
That's the – I mean, the potential payoff is like, I don't know, 20 to 1? Yeah.
Now you're paying $1 million a year for the chance that Archie Bradley's a top of the rotation starter? Fuck and yes.
Sign me up, baby. You're way low, Chris. Everyone would take that. All 30 teams would say yes in a second.
Except for the White Sox.
Right, because they don't want to go over slot or something. They don't want to make Bits Bud Selig mad and continue to ruin their team.
This is how we feel about it, Chris.
Our next email comes from Matt. Matt's in Cleveland. That's in Ohio, Jason.
I wouldn't know.
Matt, by the way, says, I completely agree with Kevin that Cleveland is a very underrated city. And it has grown on me immensely in my time here. So there you go.
Gotta make do with where you are.
But Matt writes, Kevin and Jason, I am a 0.9er due to long hours in the lab staring at computer screens, but that really isn't relevant. I'm currently finishing up my senior year of college. I'm unable to go travel as I see minor league games, and especially not the ones that involve my favorite team's prospects. My question has to do with the kind of information one can get from a single box score or reading them religiously before going to bed every night. Is it simply being happy with success, or are you looking for things that are contrary to scouting reports you have, such as a guy showing power who hasn't before, or a player suddenly taking a bunch of walks? Any help you could give in becoming more critical and less overreactionary to ridiculously small sample size would be much appreciated, Matt. Well, Matt, I think you came to the right place because I look at every box score of every game.
Right, every day.
It is part of my job. And so, I mean, I do generate a lot of questions from box scores. It's important to say that I don't generate a lot of answers from box scores. But I do generate a lot of questions that I need to follow up from. Hey, is this guy doing much better? Hey, why is Alex Hassan of the Pirates out? Why does he have 4 home runs? I don't understand this. Hey, is something going on? Or, you know, is this just a fluke? I'll find a scout and talk to him. Hey, this guy's, like you said, drawing more walks. Hey, this guy's striking out a ton. Hey, this guy's really struggling. Is this a small sample size, or is Anthony Goes having some problems?
He's having some problems.
Right. Is Anthony Rizzo, has he shortened his swing, or is he just taking advantage of Iowa? He's shortened his swing. Anthony Rizzo looks better. His swing looks better than it did last year. And so you end up in that kind of world. And so, you know, I'm lucky enough where I can actually then call people and follow up while you stare at computer screens. But I do have a couple tips for you, which is you got to remember you end up in a situation where pitching lines don't matter in terms of runs. And I'll give you a great example. And Jason, you'll be able to answer this question. If you look at two guys at low A, right? There's a pitching matchup at low A between Smith and Jones. Smith throws a two-hitter, goes 9 innings, 2 hits, no runs, 1 walk, 3 strikeouts. Jones goes 5 innings. 5 innings, 6 hits, 4 runs, 4 walks, 11 strikeouts. Which one do you think is the better pitching prospect?
I think the guy who misses the most bats.
Oh, yeah, he is.
Probably means he has better stuff, and right. Better stuff is what allows a pitcher to climb.
Right, exactly. And so when you look at those kind of things, when you look at box scores, sometimes you see those low A two hitters with 3 Ks, and I just go, hey, whatever. I mean, those, you know, two hitter in the big leagues is going to excite me, and I'll go, oh, I bet he was awesome, and I bet he was getting all sorts of weak contact and just keeping guys off balance. I bet it was awesome. And if I see at low A, like a two hitter with 3 Ks, I'm going to go, next.
I mean, and context is so important here, because if a guy throws a two hitter in A ball, you have to look at the lineup he's facing, because there may not be a legitimate prospect on that side of the field. He may just be filling up the strike zone with a fastball that's about average, and they're just dinking it, you know. And that happens a lot in A ball. You know, pitchers who can throw strikes can pitch two hitters. It's right. Not out of the ordinary at all.
If you can throw strikes and spin a breaking ball, you can crush low minors hitters.
Yeah, sure.
Next email comes from Mark. Mark is near Toronto. That's a third Canadian email, Jason.
Is that a record?
I think it might be. We'll have to look into that.
Yes.
This is when we need the up and in wiki to go. And
I'm surprised that we don't have one.
Yeah, right? What's wrong with you people? We need an up and in wiki. You could index all the musical guests and then show guests and all the email subjects that people could. Because I get people go, hey, what was the show where you talked about this? I don't know. I don't remember. But Mark has a tale of insanity. And Mark says, I recently discovered your podcast and started listening to it around the 88th edition. I love the chemistry, content, and flow of each episode, so I decided to peruse the archives. I listened to the episodes which reviewed the top 10 of each team's system, and then I decided it was time to start at the beginning. This is noteworthy because of the fact that I'm home all day right now on disability, which allows a ton of free time. There I am, mowing down the archives, 3 to 4 at a sitting.
Jesus.
When I stumble across you both laughing at someone who listened to 3 in a row. I've listened to 16 in a span of 3 days.
I'm not sure if that's want, man.
I don't know what that is. And my shame is evident by the look of my red face. Grinning and bearing it, I've continued on and haven't looked back. I'm sure the day will come very soon where I run out of archived episodes. But until then, I'm passing the time each day with you two on the speakers. 16 in 3 days.
Wow. That guy might need to be on the show. That's a lot, man.
Now, we got a lot of feedback from last week's Tales of Want, if you will. Now, yeah. Basically, we need with the marriage counseling and we should turn this into an email segment. So it's time now for this week's edition of Tales of Want.
We should have a Tales of Want every week.
And this email comes to us from Adam, and Adam writes, Howdy, Kevin and the Professor. I'm a huge fan of the show. In light of the emails from last week's episode concerning the incorporation of want into the projectability of wives and cats, I figured I should write in to convey my story of solidarity. I'm a third-year law student in Boston, currently working in the public defender's office. As a third year with the required certification, I'm able to represent clients in certain pretrial hearings. I recently had a kid who was arrested for unarmed robbery for stealing a college kid's iPod. His bail was set in district court at a pretty high amount given the facts and the circumstances, so I appealed it to Superior Court. One factor judges consider when looking at whether bail should be reduced is a defendant's ties to the community, which can include education. I explained to the judge that this is a young man who comes from a rough background but is currently on schedule to graduate high school and applying to area universities in hopes of pursuing various academic and athletic pursuits in both track and football. As I wrapped up the argument, I concluded to my surprise by stating, quote, As you can see, Your Honor, this is a young man who, despite numerous difficulties, is making efforts to take his life in a positive direction and on a whole displays a lot of want.
That's fantastic.
As soon as I said it, I couldn't believe it. I waited for the judge or the prosecutor to pounce on it and demand to know what I meant, but neither did. The judge then ordered the bail to be reduced by $1,000. Love you both. Adam, Tales of Want.
That's fantastic, Adam. That's awesome.
We'll take a break on Tales of Want. We'll come back. We'll talk all sorts of baseball, and then we'll do the goofy stuff. So stick around. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm talking about baseball, Jason.
Good.
Before we start, real quick, Jason and I were talking about this before we hit the record button. We got a lot of feedback, ton of feedback about last week's special guest, Steve Berthiaume of ESPN, who was totally awesome. And Steve has tweeted some things about the show that are incredibly kind. And he's also had a couple tweets where he's used the term want. And we feel like we're this close to hearing Steve drop a want on ESPN baseball tonight. And we know Steve listens to the show. And now Steve, we can't always watch the show. Often we are late night people. We're often working, watching games, talking to scouts who are on their way home from games. But if you can give us a heads up and you drop want on the show, $100 to the charity of your choice. You have to drop the want properly in proper context. $100 charity of your choice. That's the want challenge to Steve Berthiaume.
That's damn. You're paying for it now, aren't you?
Absolutely. I just think it would be that. I think it's $100 cool as far as I'm concerned. So no huge surprise, everybody, but it was announced that Pudge Rodriguez is retiring. There's gonna be a ceremony in the great state of Texas for him, and one of the greatest catchers of all time. And such a strange and fantastic player, Jason, on a scouting and a real world level.
Oh yeah, I mean he's that type of package just doesn't come around very often. I mean he had Hall of Fame type of tools, and you know he's a Hall of Fame type of player. I saw him when I was a younger man, when I was a teenager, and it was in the early 90s, and I saw him gun Ricky Henderson when Ricky Henderson was Ricky Henderson.
Right.
And I had never seen a catcher gun somebody like that before. And, of course, I played baseball, but I didn't focus on it with the same intensity. And so it really stood out to me visually that a little guy behind the plate with that sort of arm, that it was just a laser. And he gunned, one of my favorite players in the history of baseball. You didn't see catcher's gun Ricky Henderson like that. And he did. And then he looks good at the plate. And then he got better, much better at the plate.
Yeah. And it's easy to forget what kind of prospect he was coming up. He got to the big leagues solely on defense. That's it. He was rushed all along by Texas because he was just so damn good defensively. But a career minor league on base percentage of .296. With 13 home runs in 279 games. I mean, he was not much to talk about at all offensively, but he was so remarkably wonderful defensively. And I don't know how many gold gloves did he win, like 12?
All of them, I think, yeah.
The bat came around, and he was actually, by the time he was 22, 23, he was one of the better offensive catchers in the game.
Yeah, I mean, Texas in the mid-90s, those guys all became incredible hitters,
For various reasons.
For various reasons, but, he's just one of those players that I always liked watching. The defense obviously really stood out. That arm was really, really special. The way he would backpick runners was always a highlight. When a catcher has that sort of ability and confidence in their arm to backpick, backpick a guy from second. Backpick guys from first. It was a lot of fun to watch him play, and I'm glad I got to grow up watching him play. He was it's cool. I'm glad I got to see it.
Yeah, just a ridiculously crazy, great great catcher, and a guy who in his career finishes up throwing out 46%
Wow.
of opposing base stealers. And in his prime, he had six straight years where he led the league, including the insane 2001 year where he gunned down 60% of opposing base stealers at a time when no one would run on him.
I don't even know what to say to that. I mean, that's just remarkable.
It's just amazing. In 2001, 68 guys went, 35 of them got gunned down.
I mean, he had an incredibly strong arm, obviously. He had a lightning-quick release.
Yeah, there was like an 80 arm with a crazy release.
With fast release, tons of accuracy. His footwork was just really special. He was balanced. I mean, he's absolutely perfect, you know, back there.
And so ends his career with, 2,800 something hits, 311 home runs. Here, something people didn't realize about. He actually was a good athlete, too, despite being Pudge. 127 stolen bases in his career.
Oh, yeah.
Including four double-digit seasons.
Oh, he was an all-around. He was an all-around threat.
So
that's a Hall of Famer.
Here's to you, Pudge. You were awesome. I loved watching him play. A guy that, on a scouting level, all catchers are compared to.
And I love that.
So let's talk about baseball, Jason. And
okay.
The big leagues are off.
You mean like big league baseball?
Big league baseball. The guys with the big boy pants.
All right.
And there's some teams off to surprising starts. And I think some of them are teams where I would say that this team is better than a lot of people thought they would be. And then there are others where I'm not so sure.
Okay, and, let's go through them.
Well, there's two teams in each league that stood out for me. And in the American League, you have the Baltimore Orioles, who actually opened tonight. Tonight it's Thursday. Entered the night in first place in the American League East.
Yeah,
at 7-5. No, of course they're not going to win the friggin' American League East. Everyone knows that.
Well, if the question is it real? My answer is it is not.
But I do think the Baltimore Orioles are better than people think they are. I don't think this is a horrible team at all.
Well, I think it's been what, 12 games, 13 games, and there are a couple of games above 500.
Yeah.
The division is absolutely going to sodomize them later on in the year. So, No. I don't think it's real. I'm not on record. I'm on record saying it's not real. And I just don't like it.
But I think this team could win 75 games this year.
Ooh. That's tough.
That's a good team. Matt Wieters is really good.
Matt Wieters is a really good player.
Adam Jones is really good.
Well, he'll be gone in the summer.
Chris Davis is hitting
Chris
now.
Davis.
Nolan Reimel's having a good year. Nick Marques is not. But pitching wise, this is where things change. Where Jake Arrieta has looked great, and I think he's going to continue to look kind of good. Brian Mattis, after what seemed like a nice spring, has been awful again.
Yeah, I'm afraid of that.
But I watched Wei Yin Chen pitch.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. Like back of the rotation battler, sure, he's going to be able to do that. I think this team's pretty, they're not very good, but I think they're okay. I don't think they're an awful team. The funny thing is like if they win 75, they still might finish fifth.
That's a good point.
But I like this team. I don't think they're as bad as people think. And another team that I don't think is as bad as people think is a team playing 500 baseball right now. And I think they can play 500 baseball all year, despite being the subject of several LOLs, Chicago White Sox.
Yeah, I don't agree with you there either. I don't. I mean, look. Okay, I will say this: they are in a division where 500 is feasible.
I picked them to finish second in this division.
Well, I mean, if you look at like the way the Twins and the Royals. Yeah, I mean, if the way the Twins and the Royals have been playing, I mean, a 500 team might be second place.
Yeah, they're gonna. I think they could finish second place and be 17 games out.
There's so little on their roster that I actually give a shit about watching.
But there's so many guys in their roster who are not total black holes. I mean, obviously Konerko is a great hitter. One of my favorite hitters to watch, actually.
Yeah, he can swing it. Yeah, he's a good hitter.
He has such a remarkably good approach. It's an amazing approach.
And it's boring to me, though. He's a boring player to me.
I actually love watching him because of how remarkable his approach is. And when I say that, I realize Paul Konerko is not a guy who's going to walk 100 times a year, but I think his approach might be as good as anyone in baseball. He has a shape in mind that he is going to swing at. If ball is anywhere in that shape, he's going to swing at it. And if it's not, he's not. And he never leaves that, ever. It's one of the most disciplined approaches I've ever seen.
I respect it. I respect his talent. It's just not many people on their roster. I like watching Addison Reed.
I like watching Alexi Ramirez play defense.
Sure. That's a couple of players, but I mean, if one of the players that you're excited about is a reliever, it's not enough, man.
They do have a lot of mediocre players, but I don't think they have a lot of bad players.
And I view the talent at the major league level kind of like how you view the Hall of Fame. You know, give me something. Give me something worth watching.
Speaking of Alexi Ramirez, and I'm going to go on a little digression. Do you have an iPad?
I do not.
Like the MLB app on the iPad. After every game, there is like you can click on the game and just like the MLTV on your computer, you can like hit a game and get a box with all like the highlights.
Sure.
And at the end of the night, I tend to go through every game and just watch defensive highlights. I don't watch the home runs. I don't watch the game winning singles. I just want to see all the great defensive plays.
Well, I mean, who doesn't like really nice defensive plays?
I don't know. But so you don't like the O's or the White Sox, and I think both teams could win 75 to 80 games. National League, you have the Los Angeles Dodgers at 9-3, but they've played nobody. They've beaten up on the Pirates and the Padres before they ran to Milwaukee this week.
Sure.
This is one I don't believe in.
No, I don't believe in them either, but I actually don't think that I think that they're going to be a pretty decent team. I mean, they have players that I really like watching. They have superstars. You know, they have two superstars, and that's enough. I think that they're going to be – I think that they're a 500 team, but, you know, that's not bad.
That's not bad. The lineup's so bad after camp. And
that's the problem.
And obviously, Ethier's been great too, but, you know, Ethier's not going to be that good or he's going to get hurt.
Or traded.
But after that, I mean, you're watching – guys like Juan Rivera and James Loney and D. Gordon, I think D. Gordon's hitting 500 when I see him play and 000 when I don't.
Yeah, I mean, I've been opinionated about the guy before.
He's going to prove you wrong.
He is not at this point proving me wrong. He's proving me right. But I will say about the Dodgers is that I hope that they go deep into the postseason just because I love watching Kershaw and just because I love watching Kemp. And anytime I get to watch them at home, it's a privilege because of the voice behind the mic.
Oh yeah, and I actually like watching their bullpen because Kenley Jansen just
I like watching his mechanics.
Throws balls hard. Have you seen Chad Billingsley this year?
No, not in person, but yeah,
it's weird. It's like oh yeah, I remember how good we thought he was going to be, and now he's pitching like that. I know it's just three starts, but he's been amazing. He's been the guy we go, oh yeah, that guy.
Hey, what happened to him? And people forgot what happened to him.
He was like a top pick. He was not a top pick. He was like a top prospect.
He looked really good once he got into baseball.
He was a late first round pick out of Ohio, and in all the up in the minors, it was like this guy's going to be, you know, a two, maybe a one, and then pitched really, really well in the big leagues, like at age 22 and 23.
Really well.
Really well. I mean, for a 22 and 23 year old, he was a monster. He just kind of stagnated, if not downright regressed, over the last couple years.
He just disappeared, basically. I mean, I think people thought he was out of baseball.
Do you think it's because his ass is so enormous?
I think his body is a problem, yeah. I think it's part of the problem.
It's such a strange body.
He has a strange ass.
So he's too wide.
He's wide. He has to buy special pants.
But if you three
but
starts,
he's pitching well.
Three starts, very optimistic that Chad Billingsley
I always liked him, yeah.
Could get closer to the kind of guy we thought he would be when he was coming up. And of course the story of the National League is the Washington Nationals, who are 10-3.
That may be real though, man.
Really?
And I'll tell you why. I was tweeting about this not too long ago. I've started to watch Zimmerman's starts, just going back on MLB TV.
He's really good.
Yeah, here's the secret, everybody. He's really fucking good. I mean, I don't think people realize what kind of stuff this kid has.
Yeah.
He has top-of-the-rotation stuff. He's not getting a ton of support on the offensive side of it, but, man, this kid is a really, really, really good pitcher. You know, and I wouldn't be shocked if he has a longer career than the ace, than Strasburg.
And Strasburg's been great and is going to get better. Gio Gonzalez is really good.
Guys who can miss bats.
Right. Edwin Jackson's been up and down because he's Edwin Jackson. And Ross Detweiler hasn't looked bad in his couple of starts. And the lineup, there's some stuff there. It's not a great lineup, but it's a competitive lineup. They can score some runs here and there.
I think that if they can just, you know, squeak out a few runs a game, the right hitters get hot at the right time. You know, you get some stuff from Worth. With that type of pitching, they're going to win a lot of ball games.
Yeah, they got, you got crazy Henry Rodriguez closing out games. And
right. So I think it's real. I think the Nats are real.
How real? Playoff real?
Oh.
I picked them as my second wild card.
I did not, and I may regret that. I did not, but I did not. You know, with that rotation, you know, just with the top three, that's a dangerous team if they get into postseason baseball.
Yes.
You know, I didn't think that I was going to have to concern myself with the offensive side for the Nationals, but they need to step it up there because they have the rotation here to win games. You know, they need to score some runs. They need to get hot. But, yeah, I think that they might be a playoff team, yeah. I'll be wrong here.
In the National League East, look who's 7-5. It's the New York Mets.
Yeah, I'm not there with them.
The New York Mets are the Chicago White Sox of the American League, in that everyone likes to make fun of them, but they're really not that bad a team. They're actually a pretty mediocre team.
Well, I think that's a pretty good way of looking at it. They're not a terrible team. They're just a mediocre team.
Right. Everybody left the LOL Mets. Ha ha. They're awful. No, they're not awful. They're just, you know, mediocre. And I think they'll also win 75-80 games.
They're just not a very exciting team.
No.
It's like going to the dentist to watch them play.
Yeah, it's watching paint dry sometimes. They don't have there's no pitchers that are like, holy crap, that guy's pitching. I really want to see him. And there's not a whole lot of people. There's no one in the lineup that where you go, oh, holy crap, he's up. I need to see that. Except for David Wright, who's been kind of going crazy. But yeah, it's not an exciting team. It's not a very interesting team, but it's a mediocre team.
Yeah, I'll give you that. They are mediocre.
So let's get to prospects, Jason.
Finally.
And I wrote a piece this week about the 2011 draft. And
good piece.
The pitching in the 2011 draft. And look, I know it is crazy, crazy early. And you shouldn't judge a draft for 3, 5, maybe 10 years. But after 10 days, I want to talk about the 2011 draft and what they've done so far this year. Because this has a chance to be really huge. This is a chance to be a historic draft when it comes to pitching. And I was doing some research to try to, I was like, well, what are we comparing it to? What are the other best drafts for pitching? And look, I know wins are not a great statistic, but wins are nice in the sense that it just gives a real quick run for guys who pitched well and got the opportunity simply to get 100 wins.
Pitched long enough.
So I said, you know, so I basically just said, you know, how many first rounds created the most, what first round created, including supplemental picks, created the most 100 game winners? And I really thought I'd find one that produced 6 or 7. But no first round in the history of baseball has produced more than 3. 3! And just 100 games, not 200, 100 wins. No first round has produced more than 3. Now, the 0-2 one's probably going to change that. There's a lot of guys on their way. But 3 is that's not a hell of a benchmark. And, I mean, look, obviously the 2011 draft was a pitching-heavy draft. But the first 3 picks were Gerrit Cole, who everyone seems to have forgotten about and is a fool if they do that.
Because the stuff is still there.
Just because he hasn't thrown 27 scoreless innings doesn't mean he stinks. Danny Hulson, who's in Double-A and has had some good starts and some bad starts, but is probably going to be in the big leagues this year. Trevor Bauer, same as Hulson, has some good starts and some bad starts, but going to be in the big leagues this year. And then Dylan Bundy, who's the talk of the town. 3 outings, 9 innings, no hits, 1 walk, 15 strikeouts.
Right. That's good.
Yeah, he's been kind of good. In other words, I wrote a scouting report on him today at BP. I talked to a scout who's at one of those 3-inning outings. And we got an email from Anthony. And Anthony will always really be in the Podcast Fan Hall of Fame, as Anthony was the first person to ever show up at our first bar event.
Oh, okay.
And Anthony writes, the other day Kevin tweeted about his dislike for organizations pitching its young pitchers in low A for only 3 innings at a time. Someone like Dylan Bundy comes to mind. That's who I was talking about, Anthony. He's pitched 3 innings in each of his 3 games that he started. If you let him pitch deeper into games and he reaches an inning limit earlier in the year, you have to shut him down. What does that pitcher do? Does he not throw at all? Does he not pitch in live games? I understand limiting innings and pitch counts, but what would be the preferred way for doing this? Well, I just want to be, I did complain about the three innings thing, but to be frank, I used the term annoyed. I was annoyed with it. That doesn't mean I think it's wrong to do. I was annoyed with it because it gives us not enough information to really judge a guy. We can get all excited about Dylan Bundy. And look, I had Dylan Bundy higher than anyone. On anyone's top 100, I had Dylan Bundy higher than anyone. He was my number one talent going into the draft last year. But I still think people are getting too excited about Dylan Bundy because it's three innings at a time. We have not seen him stretched out. We have not seen him challenged. We haven't seen him have to face a lineup a second time around.
Yeah, it's really hard to scout in bursts like that. I mean, you get a look at, you know, a snapshot of stuff. You can see the mechanical profile. You know, obviously he's had really good results. Obviously he looks really, really good.
Yeah, he looks great.
But it's a difficult scouting assignment when you're watching snapshots like that of a kid who, you know, and look, here's the thing about them going three innings from a developmental standpoint. I mean, that's their call. They're going to take their own approach.
And mm-hmm.
If you want to, you know, sometimes I've been asked this and I just explain it like, you know, every team is going to be different. It's an organizational philosophy. It's a developmental plan. And, you know, look at it like he's a winning lottery ticket. And they're just really careful about how they're going around walking with it. You know,
yeah.
They're keeping it in, you know, in Lucite, and they're not touching it. And they're being very, very careful. And there's going to come a time where they're going to have to pull it out and let's see what it is. Let's see if it actually is a winner. And that's going to happen. Dylan Bundy is going to pitch enough for everyone to get their fix. It's very, very early. It'll happen.
Right. But it's going to take a while. But to go back to the email we had about box scores, if I see Dylan Bundy go three hitless innings and he strikes out six, and I see Archie Bradley go 6 one-hit innings and he strikes out nine, I'm actually more impressed with Bradley.
Well, of course, because he's got to get into sequence. You know,
He's got to do some pacing. He's got to go through that lineup a second time around. That's actually a more impressive job.
Well, so far this year, I know Bundy's getting a ton of heat, and that's great. But, I'm getting the same sort of response about Bradley when he's going.
Yep.
That he is absolutely showing that he is too good for the level he's on. And that's crazy because he's a high school kid.
Right. And, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, right now, if you talk to the scouts if you let scouts see a Bundy start and then a Bradley start, I really think you'd probably end up pretty even as far as preference.
You know what? And it that's remarkable to me. So you, going back to this entire premise here,
yes.
You know, you have a guy like Garrett Cole who, I liked how you said it, that, you know, he's being overlooked a little bit just because he's not, you know, 27 up, 27 down. This is a guy who, he had a similar problem in college where he had the best stuff around. You know, he had a 70 to 80 fastball, 70, you know, a slider, 70 changeup, but he didn't dominate like Bauer did. You know, and he's kind of having a similar problem where he's not. When you watch him, you're like, well, where are the 70 results?
Yeah.
And I think that it's just going to. This is one of those things that there will come a time where the light is either going to go on for him, and he's going to learn how to use his stuff to miss bats and to dominate, or it's not going to happen for him, and he's just going to become a pitcher.
He's just
going to become a guy.
Or he might just become a closer.
Yeah, but he's just going to be a guy. He's not going to be the number one pick in the draft.
Right.
But he still has a chance to be that. It's too early to say that this guy, that, you know, maybe Bundy should have been picked first, or Bradley, or I get a lot of this, and, you know, there's a lot of good points there, and hindsight's great, but Cole is still a very, very good arm, and I'm sure there's a lot of teams in baseball right now that would gladly take him as the number one pick.
Absolutely. There's no question about it.
Well, we go through the rest of this. Danny Holson at number two. This is a guy who I've been told, hey, I wouldn't be shocked if he's a number three starter for 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, the most polished and the most big league ready of all the guys.
Well, there's a ton of value in that. I mean, Bauer, I know people love Bauer. His numbers are, everybody wants him up at the major league level. They love his numbers. I mean, he still has some stuff to work on, too. This is not a guy who's going to win the Cy Young right out of the chute. You know, he's interesting. You know, he's unique, but I mean, he's a really talented arm, but I mean, he still has some development, you know, there's still some development there. There's development with all these guys
because they look
good early.
Guys, you know, I know everyone's excited about Trevor Bauer. And I'll repeat this because I say it a lot, but I'm going to say it again. Let's quit worrying about how he throws funny and uses rubber bands and just worry about how he pitches. But Trevor Bauer this year has walked 12 guys in 15 and two-thirds innings.
Right, he's showing some serious command issues, and he's...
Which he had throughout college, too. There's a big efficiency issue with Trevor Bauer. Trevor Bauer is at 110 pitches after the sixth because he's not an efficient pitcher.
Well, I mean, that's going to come back to get you at the major league level. I mean, you can't see he still has room to develop, which is
right. Nice,
which is great. I mean, that's why he's in the minors, you know. And he's another talented arm to come out of here. You go down the list some more. You run into Bradley. You run into a guy that nobody's really talking about with Jose Fernandez.
Well, I mean, I want to get to those guys. But so you have this first five. You have this Cole, Hulton, Bauer, Bundy, Bradley quintet. That's a monster. You could argue all five of those guys are among the top 20 prospects in baseball right now.
No question.
That's a monster. But and after that, there's more going on. Taylor Youngman, the 12th pick, has been pretty good. Jose Fernandez, the 14th pick, has been much more than pretty good.
He's throwing gas.
97. This is a kid who emigrated from Cuba. He's got Chad Billingsley ass, and he's throwing 97. And in his first three starts at Greensboro, low A, he's allowed 9 hits over 17 innings and struck out 25. And he's going 97 with a pretty good breaking ball. He could be pretty good. Jed Bradley, 15th pick, has been pretty good. Chris Reed's been all right. Sonny Gray's in double A already. He's been pretty good. Matt Barnes has killed it. But Matt Barnes shouldn't be at low A.
No way.
I understand why they sent him there. Like, yeah, well, let's make sure he's all right here and everything works out. He's fine. Let's move him up.
Push him a little bit here.
And you can just Joe Ross has crazy upside.
Oh, man,
big
time.
The Padres pick is a monster arm. Sean Gilmartin has no upside, but
he's
a big league. Like, you could drop him in right now probably in the back of a rotation. It's all over B, but he could probably do it right now. So that guy's got a chance to win 100 games because he could pitch forever. He throws strikes. Henry Owens has been really good for Boston at low A in the same rotation with Barnes. Andrew Chafin, who, if you remember back in the draft show, was my guy, has killed it so far in high A, pitching in the California League. In three starts for Visalia, he struck out 27 and 15 and a third, showing from a left-hander 94 miles an hour and a 70 slider.
Jesus.
I mean, we just keep going. There's tons of pitching here.
Well, you know what it needs to be said is that, before every draft, there's always a lot of hyperbole about this draft is this draft is that. Before this draft, most people in baseball were saying, we haven't seen a draft like this in a very long time. And right. I think a lot of people thought that was just, pre-CBA fluff. But, man, it was not.
The pitching is that good.
The pitching was that good.
But the pitching's been really good. As far as this draft goes, it's not very good, folks. We'll get into that on a future show.
Well, what we can do when we need to discuss the 2012 draft, we can just come back and look at the 2011 draft again, because I could do this just about every segment, because there's so much talent on this list that it's insane.
It's looking really good, folks. Let's quit talking about guys that we talk to people about and talk about people we see, Jason, because...
Sure.
You're back in New York, and you spent 4 or 5 days in the lovely town of Wilmington, Delaware.
Five full days.
Home of the Wilmington Blue Rocks.
Yeah.
Which is the High A Carolina League affiliate of the Kansas City Royals. You saw 5 games, right?
I did.
And so, besides Wilmington, you saw Wilmington play the Orioles affiliate and the Indians affiliate, I believe.
That is right.
So let's talk about some players you saw, and I want to start with the Wilmington guys, because those guys were right in front of you. And when we went over the top 101, we both kind of – or not the top 101, our minor league preview, we both picked some guys. And one of the guys I picked was a guy who I saw in instructs spring training that looked really good, and a guy I saw last year at Kane County, and he looked really good. And this year, at least numerically, he hasn't looked very good, and that's Cuthbert.
I mean, I love Cuthbert. He's just a hell of a player, and he played in 4 out of the 5 games.
He's hitting 175 without a home run so far.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, the majority of the games I was there, the weather was all right, but, it wasn't particularly warm. It was downright cold the last game. That's a kind of a hard park to hit in.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hard league to hit in, if you're a young hitter.
It's a bad park.
And I'll say this, Cuthbert has a really good approach. I like his approach to hitting. He can track a ball very well. And when I say track, I mean, like, he's able to pick up that ball early out of the hand, and he can watch it into its zones, and he doesn't swing unless it's in a zone he feels comfortable hitting and thinks he can make contact with. I saw him square several balls. Those balls just didn't find holes. And so I didn't walk away thinking, well, you know, this kid's not hitting. This kid's just kind of not really lucky right now. He's hit. He's making good contact. He doesn't look overwhelmed by the level, and that's important. You know, he's going to struggle. He's 19 years old. You know, and he's an advanced A ball in a tough climate to hit in a tough league, and you know, he's going to struggle. That said, you know, I didn't see anything in the profile to suggest that he's not going to be the same player that we both thought he was going to be. And he looked good.
And the Wilmington lineup, and I know the Royals system is very good, but the Wilmington lineup is not a prospect stacked lineup. It is not a very good lineup at all, actually, when it comes to prospects. But the Wilmington rotation, on the other hand, is really worth talking about. I want to start with two guys who we've talked about in the past and a lot of people have heard of. The first being Yordano Ventura, who you saw.
Sure.
And I know you were impressed with, and it should be noted that tonight, Yordano struck out 9 over 5 innings. To go back to the box scores, 5 innings, 6 hits, 2 runs, 9 strikeouts. As far as I'm concerned, that's a really, really great start, because in 5 innings, he struck out 9 guys. He struck out 9 of the 22 guys he faced. But I know you were texting me during the start, and you seemed to walk away very, very impressed.
I did. And he went 3 innings. He started a 4th. He threw a lot of pitches. He walked 3 guys. He struck out 6 guys. And all 6 guys went down swinging on his curveball, which is kind of the thing that we've been talking about.
That's just crazy.
When is the curveball going to, you know, start to mature a little bit? I've seen him in bursts for the most part on backfield.
Because to be clear, just so everyone knows, I mean, this guy throws in the upper 90s. This guy's touched 100.
Yeah. Every time I've seen him, he's been 96 to 98 and touched a little higher. And that's always been in bursts. And, you know, this was a start. You know, he threw a lot of pitches. And when he came back out for the 4th inning, he was still able to hit 98. You know, the fastball is legit. He can throw it. He can throw it for strikes for the most part. Sometimes he throws too many strikes. The curveball looked really, really, really good. It looked like a plus pitch. It flashed even higher than plus. He was throwing it to both lefties and righties. He was getting really awkward swings against, I will admit, a team, the Oriole team, that wasn't putting a lot of good swings on any ball.
Right.
They basically just wanted to walk and get away from him, because he was throwing, you know, the fastball was so intense. He's a little guy, and there's some effort in the delivery. A lot of people are already jumping to just, hey, he's a reliever. You know, he can throw close to 100. He's a little guy. Haven't seen the command is a little loose, might have a curveball. Let's fast track him. This kid could start. I mean, he might be able to start. I don't want to write him into the pen just yet. He's a legit prospect. I don't know where he fits. I don't know if he's a starter or a reliever.
Well, let's talk about that. Does the fact that he's 5'11" and somewhere in the neighborhood of 71 pounds bother you?
He looked a little. He's listed a little bit. I think he's listed at 170 now.
So
he's got a little bit more than when he was 140. But it's not a. He's hiding the 30 pounds well. I don't know. That's what I'm saying. I don't know where he's putting him, but. You know what? I thought that
it's
might
not,
be an
it's
issue.
Not the, at least what it wasn't last year, and maybe this has changed. Not the easiest thing in the world.
No, I don't think it's particularly easy. But that said, you know, into his 4th inning of work, he was still able to hit the upper 90s.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The development of the curveball is a big deal for me, because I always thought it was iffy. You know, I never thought his delivery was really conducive for a good curveball, and you know, it looked really, really good. I mean, there were a lot of people there who were kind of, he was just blowing people away with it. He was missing bats like crazy. Every time he threw the curveball, he got an awkward swing on it. Every single strikeout was a swinging strike on the curveball, both lefty and righty. That was good. You know, so I'd like to see him again before I put him in the pen. But if you put him in the pen, if that's his projection, he could be a 7 reliever. You know, a 770 grade reliever.
With that kind of fastball, he has something to go with it, sure.
Yeah, so, I mean, he was impressive. I got to see, my final day there, I got to see Jason Adam, which we've talked about on the show a lot.
We've talked about Jason on the show. If you don't remember, you know, he's a guy that Jason was very excited about when seeing him last spring. And, you know, he stayed back and extended for a while, came to Kane County, and I didn't see the guy Jason saw. And it wasn't even that Jason and I disagreed about it as much as the guy Jason described to me
wasn't there,
wasn't the person I saw pitching. And so, you know, it's not like Jason was, there wasn't something subjective there. It wasn't like, well, I like his curveball and I don't. Jason's like, oh, he's throwing 97. I'm like, well, he's throwing 91. And so as a different human beings, he's still not throwing very hard, but he's pitching. And he's been great so far in three starts for Wilmington. He's got a 0.51 ERA and 17 and two-thirds innings. He's allowed just one earned run. And on the night that you saw him, he had a career high in innings, went 7 2/3 innings, 5 hits, 3 walks, 5 strikeouts. And you liked what you saw.
I did. And it was the game was actually 11 in the morning. It was one of those morning games where, yep, like all the kids come from the local schools and they scream and it's, yes, annoying as fuck.
It was a reading club or something.
It was tough, but it was also in the low 50s with a wind chill and it was raining. So it was a very tough game to not only scout, but to pitch in. I mean, it wasn't an easy environment. But that said, he was 90, 92, touched 93, 94 a couple of times. He was really comfortable in the 91, 92 range. The ball had a lot of movement. You know, it wasn't an electric fastball. It wasn't nearly as electric as it was a few, you know, a year and a half ago or a year ago in bursts. That said, this was a pitcher this time. This wasn't a guy just throwing cheese. This was a real pitcher. He pitched off the fastball. He located the fastball. He busted out his curveball. His sequencing was really impressive. He busted out his mid-70s curveball. It kind of flashed as a plus pitch. It had good shape. Hitters were fooled by it. His changeup, which I hadn't really seen him bust out a whole lot, was even better than the curveball. It was around 81, 82. It didn't have as much arm side fade as it had like this funneling vertical action to it. It almost looked like a slower sinker.
Mm-hmm.
And or like a palm ball or something. But it was really it was missing bats. He was throwing it to lefties and righties alike. The pitch of the game for me was it was a 2-2 count, and it was a 2 outs in the inning, and it was righty-righty, and Adam busted out just a beautiful curveball on the inside part of the plate and walked off the mound before the call. It was beautiful. You know, it was one of those when you're just like, oh, that. I mean, that's a balls pitch. You know, that's a you can't hit this shit type of pitch. The defense behind him made 3 errors that were scored and 2 that really weren't scored.
Right.
So the defense behind him put runners on all day long. He broke 5 bats. He induced several double plays. This was a complete game that the defense took away from him.
Yeah.
He pitched a complete game. He wanted to stay in. He just hit his pitch limit. He walked a couple of guys early, but he had his shit on lockdown after a while. It wasn't Jason Adam, the hurler. It was Jason Adam, the pitcher, and I was very impressed with the pitcher part of it.
And the third guy I want to talk about is a guy who I know we've mentioned on the show. He was my Royals sleeper a couple of years ago, and he's, you know, totally fallen by the wayside. But it's Tyler Sample, who you saw good. He went 6 innings, 3 hits, 1 run, 1 walk, 7 strikeouts. And I saw this guy 2 years ago pitching, and this was a gut pick by the Royals. This was one of those where, you know, let's see what he can do here. But he's a 6'7" right-hander, and he was from Colorado, so he didn't really pitch against anyone who mattered, and it was hard to see him good. He had a Tommy John surgery when he was like a freshman or a sophomore in high school. And the first time I saw him, he threw 94, and it was the 6'7", 240 guy throwing 94. I was done saying he spun a few really nice curveballs, but like that was it. He was a mess. There's no clue what he's doing. But you're like, well, if he figures something out, he's 6'7", he throws 94, and it sounds to you like he may be figuring some things out.
Yeah, I came to the game, and this was on Tuesday, and, you know, he was pitching, and I was there to see, you know, I was excited to see Cuthbert, Eibner, on the Mudcat side. I was going to get to see, you know, Tony Walters, Ronnie Rodriguez, Jake Lowry. You know, there was a lot of talent for me to keep my attention. I didn't go there thinking that I was going to get to see anything impressive on the hill. I really didn't. He was impressive, man, and he was really good. I mean, that I mentioned this to you. He doesn't pitch like he's 6'7". Like I wasn't watching him going, man, this guy looks huge. This guy's like, you know, really creating some plane to the plate. I didn't see a ton of that, but I mean, he did have a high release. His fastball was you know, anywhere from 90 to 94. In the 94, he was just touching. He was basically working in the 89, 92 range for the most part. But his fastball was thick. You know, it was actually a really thick pitch. And they couldn't elevate the ball. You know, they were slapping it into the ground a lot. He was working really fast. His mechanics are a little funky, though. He has a pronounced bend in his back. And he's a short strider for such a big guy. And so he puts a lot of strain on his arm.
Yeah.
That said, sometimes it just works, and I don't want to be one of these guys who just breaks down the mechanics to such a degree that we lose sight of what the pitcher is actually able to do. The arm worked fine. There was a lot of effort, but it worked. You know, he threw a heavy fastball in the low 90s. He threw, his curveball was actually really good. He missed a lot of bats with it. He used it against lefties a lot. He attacked hitters. He looked like a pitcher that was way too advanced for the high A level. He looked like a guy who could be in double A pretty easily. And, you know, based on the projection that I saw, I mean, he's either, you know, a back of the rotation type of horse, or he's a guy who can pitch in middle relief, but he looked like a major league arm to me.
Yeah, no, I it wouldn't shock me. I mean, there's still a lot of time for things to go wrong there, but the core and the raw ingredients are there.
He was a shock. I didn't go there to see him. I came away thinking that he was the most impressive player that I got to see that day. You know, I had good scouting notes on all the Indians guys, and I've seen the two worthwhile names on the Blue Rocks roster. But I came away really impressed with what he did on the mound, and I ended up spending a lot of time going over my notes that I took on him.
And you said you saw them play Frederick. That's a zero roster.
There was one guy that I liked who was pitching, and his name was Mike Wright. I want to say he was like a third or fourth round pick.
Mm-hmm.
Last year. He's got size. He's like 6'4", 6'5", all leg. His legs come up to his throat. But he was athletic, and he threw a low 90s fastball down in the zone all game long. Followed it up with a couple of decent secondary pitches. He looked like he was another guy who should be in double A. He looked like another guy that could be a back of the rotation guy. Obviously, you know, he could be a little bit more if it comes together. But, you know, I didn't think I would see any major league quality talent on that roster. Of all the 29 guys on the roster sheet that I was given, not a single one was born outside of the United States.
Wow.
Not a single player.
That's amazing. An A-ball roster without a Latin American kid?
There were 29 guys on my roster sheet. Not all were active. Of the 29 guys on the Frederick roster sheet, not a single player was born outside of the United States.
Holy shit, that's insane.
Yeah, and because it's not like, look, I know how the Orioles are and the reputation they get, but not all of their affiliates have that. So this is kind of an anomaly.
It's a bit of a weird thing, yeah.
You know, I know they're not known for acquiring Latin American talent, but not a single player on the roster. And, you know, to be honest, they're not a very good team, and there's not a lot of talent on that team, and that's obviously one of the reasons why. But, Mike Wright was worth watching. Nobody else did anything for me.
And on that Carolina team, there's some guys to watch, including KG fave Ronnie Rodriguez, who I'm sure we'll be talking about much during the year. But I want to ask you about a player that we've talked about a lot of these players because we're friends and we talk about things while you see them. Mm-hmm. But there's a guy I didn't ask you about who's on the Carolina Mudcats roster. Mm-hmm. And he's a guy who has consistently put up some really good numbers. And Indians fans consistently say, when are you going to get on the bandwagon for this guy? And I consistently tell them, I'm not interested. And that's first baseman Jesus Aguilar.
Oh, man. That guy's a terrible athlete. I mean, it's bad, man. Here's the thing about him. For a big guy, he actually has bat speed. His swing is not incredibly long. I saw him, you know, pull velocity. That's legitimate. He's not a terrible hitter.
Yeah.
He's not a major league quality hitter, and his body is low minors quality.
He is listed at 6'3", 257.
That's generous on the weight because he's got he's got an ass.
He's got a belly, too.
He's got two asses. He's got a belly. He's not a very good athlete. I almost clocked him with a Billy Butler-esque time to first base. It was like close to 5 seconds. He doesn't really move well around the base, but you know, as I said, his swing isn't terrible. He has some bat speed, but no, he's a minor league player for me. He's a minor league first baseman.
That's why I'm not in the bandwagon, folks.
Yeah, in person it just wasn't good. Because look, next to him on the diamond when I was watching him was Ronnie Rodriguez and Tony Walters, who, you know, they should have had their places switched. Rodriguez should have been at short. He was at short the final game. But when you're watching those two, when you see a body like Aguilar, you're like, no. No. Those other two at least have some projection to the majors.
And Ronnie Rodriguez is the guy who I ranked number two on my Indians list and other people didn't touch. Because I thought he was really impressive last year. And I talked to scouts who were really impressed with a guy doing what he did as a 19-year-old in his first year of professional baseball, period. Didn't play in the DSL, didn't play complex. That was his first year of professional baseball. He's off to a really good start in Carolina. He's hitting 300 with a 364 on base, a 475 slugging. And you ended up, I think like a lot of people, where you're like, there's a lot to like here, there's a lot of holes in the game.
Yeah, he has a lot of holes. There is a lot to like. First of all, he's very athletic.
Mm-hmm.
He's extremely strong for his age. He has a very thick upper body and build, kind of a inverted triangle upper body, and it's built. He has a high butt, good legs, no neck. He looks like a football player, kind of. I like the body. I like the way it's going to project. This is a guy who's going to continue to develop into a type of hitter. Or a type of a certain physicality that he brings to the table is going to continue. He's not going to lose his athleticism like some players do when they age.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I don't. I'm not sure he's a shortstop long term, just because he might get pretty thick up top, and his actions with the at the position are a little sloppy, to say the least. I wouldn't say that he's a fundamental player.
No,
I think. His arm is plenty strong, but he's very casual with his throwing mechanics. He's pretty casual with his game in general. He's just an ultra-aggressive type of player. I see that, you know, to project to play shortstop at the major league level, I really want to see, you know, not elite, but, you know, a well above average type of skills at that position at a young age, and I don't see them from him. I see, you know, he might be able to stay there for a little while, but long term, I don't see him staying there unless he can like really take some developmental steps forward with the fundamentals, which is entirely possible.
I'm gonna throw a comp at you.
Yeah.
And not the most famous player in the world, but a guy who played in the big leagues for 15 years, Jose Hernandez, who came up with the Cubs, then played with the Braves. Had his best years with the Brewers earlier in the 2000s, where he would hit like 240 with 20 home runs. But a guy who, you know, was a second division starter, and he, you know, when he hit 250, he'd do enough around it where it really mattered. He'd hit 15, 20 home runs. He'd draw 40, 50 walks and play all over the field.
And this is a very interesting comp because we were talking about this. It's not, I had to look the player up. I had forgotten who this guy was. But it makes a lot of sense because this guy is ultra aggressive. He's going to K a ton. He's not going to hit for average, but he's going to hit for power. And this is the thing about Ronnie Rodriguez is that this kid is going to hit for power. You know, at what cost? That's still to be determined. I mean, how much right. average is he going to have to sacrifice? He comes up to the plate with near top shelf bat speed, you know, and he swings like, you know, kind of like Tavares, except it's not as in control. It's very aggressive. I wrote this in my piece that should be up today on Baseball Prospectus that he was delivered a 91 mile an hour fastball above the hands inside, and he got on top of it and chopped it. To the third baseman.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen anything quite like that. How did he get on top of that ball? What the hell was he doing to get on top of the ball? And while I was impressed with the bat speed, I had to then question why he would swing at that pitch. You know, and he did this a lot. He was swinging at a lot of pitches that he shouldn't have been swinging at. You know, and yeah, some that he was able to barrel. I mean, he hit one at the base of the wall with all just an upper body, all hands type of bat speed approach. And you know, it was you could see the bat speed, you could see the power potential. Just his overall approach to the game is ultra aggressive and it's kind of hair on fire. And those type of players have to learn to slow it down and play with their athleticism and not just play athletically. Because right now he just looks like an athlete running around playing baseball. He needs to develop into a baseball player. But he was a lot better than Tony Walters, obviously. I mean, this is a guy that has the realistic tools to at least stay at shortstop, and he has major league quality power potential and speed. Walters doesn't have anything like that.
Right, and Walters has been really struggling this year.
Well, he's way out. He's you know, he's struggling with this league. He's over his head with this league. And I appreciate – look, he's a gamer. I understand why you make this move. This is a gritty gamer type of kid who, you know, he makes pitchers work. You know, he gets to balls that he can get to. You know, he doesn't have crazy range, but if it's coming at him, he's probably going to try to make a play on it. He doesn't have a strong arm. He doesn't have the range for short. He doesn't have a lot of power potential.
He has to hit or he's in all sorts of trouble.
He has to hit, and I don't see enough bat there for it, and I don't see, you know, he has a decent approach, you know, but people are, if you're not afraid of him, they're going to challenge him. He's going to have to use the stick. I don't see it. I mean, I think that he could be a fringy major leaguer, kind of a utility type if everything clicks, but that's the best case. So on that field, I mean, and also, what's his name? The catcher was on the field as well. Jake Lowry was on that field, and a lot of people have sent me comments about him, and I don't think he's a good catcher at all.
Right.
I mean, he was popping 2-2, 2-3 most of the time. His arm was not a plus tool like everybody seems to suggest. It was a 5 at best for me. The bat was okay. I didn't get to see enough of the bat, but the bat was okay, but he's not going to hit enough to be a first baseman. So I don't know. I don't even know if he's a prospect at this point.
So on that,
wasn't crazy thick.
On that good news, we'll take a break and we'll come back and we'll just do the goofy stuff. And then we'll be done, Jason.
Right on.
Stick around. Welcome back to the show. It's time for the goofy stuff, Jason.
All right.
We begin with our musical guests, and it's the return engagement. It's the return of screaming females. I know we've played a lot of fairly mellower stuff of late, and a lot of it's been really good, and we've gotten great reception from it. We're getting a little louder tonight with screaming females, kind of a garage rock / punk band from New Jersey. They come to us courtesy of Don Giovanni Records, who has been awesome to us from day one of this show, and hello, and big thanks to Joe Steinhardt, who runs the show over there. This is off their new album called Ugly. And, I mean, this is a band that's, you know, getting some hype and some heat and things like that. They, you know, were featured in Rolling Stone and Spin and Guitar World. They were on network television. It's not the biggest network television show, but fuck it, they were on network television. They were on Last Call with Carson Daly a couple months ago. And again, this is their new album, Ugly. And Ugly was recorded in Chicago by Steve Albini at the Electrical Audio Studios. And so, you know, it sounds good as well, Jason.
Yeah, and it's a concept album about Matt Adams' body, right?
No, it is not.
Okay.
And a return podcast guest produced by a former podcast guest. You can't beat that. And it's a nice tribute to what they do over Electrical Audio, where, you know, Steve Albini produced the Pixies, he produced Plant and Page, he produced Nirvana's In Utero. But if you can scrape up the fairly reasonable rate of $700 a day, he'll produce your record too. He is a working producer at a working studio that he runs, and that's the rate, and whoever can pays it gets recorded by Steve Albini. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And it goes quick because he records nearly everything live. He is not a track recorder kind of guy. So that's the band. The new album's called Ugly. It's on Don Giovanni Records. You can order it. You can get all your digital download stuff. You can buy CDs or LPs at Don Giovanni Records. This is a hardworking band. They just got out of the East Coast and the Midwest, and they're now on the West Coast. If you're listening to this today on Friday, they'll be playing The No in Portland on Friday. On Saturday, they'll be in Olympia, Washington. Then they're going to go head south. And on Monday, they'll be in Oakland at 1234 Go Records, 24th in San Francisco at Bottom of the Hill, and then they just kind of keep going south. Then they kind of head back this way. Then they're in Texas in May. And then they're in Florida in June. They got dates booked all the way through July. This is a touring working band.
Nice. That's hard to do.
And they're playing something in Austin, Texas on June 1st, some sort of festival that's known as Chaos in Tejas. So
I'm not even familiar with that, but I'm into it.
So go see them, and big thanks to Screaming Females, and thanks to Don Giovanni Records. It's time for a very important question, Jason.
Yep.
A little more excitement, Jason. It's time for a very important question, Jason.
Hit me with it.
What are you drinking?
I'm drinking Diet Coke. I'm not drinking anything fancy. I apologize. I haven't been drinking a lot lately. I've been really busy lately, and I'll tell you what, it's hot in my apartment right now, and I just don't feel like making the effort to drink alcohol.
So you're having a Diet Coke.
I'm having a Diet Coke on ice, and I've been drinking just a ton of water. I'm still dehydrated from Arizona, I think. I mean, I didn't drink a ton in Arizona at all because I was just thirsty all day long. And I chewed sunflower seeds most of the day, and I'm just really thirsty. I just can't break this thirst. So I haven't been going to alcohol. I haven't been turning to alcohol to quench my thirst. So it's boring, and hopefully next week I will be drinking something better. That's the plan.
Excellent.
What about you?
Well, Jason, you know, you said it's hot in your apartment. Of course, the weather is warming up all around the country, even though it's not quite warm here. I am nonetheless enjoying a Leinenkugel's Summer Shandy, which is beer with natural lemonade flavor.
All right.
It is a Weiss beer with lemonade, brewed by the Leinenkugel Brewery Company in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. And that's really all I can tell you. It's actually quite delicious.
Sure.
It's got beer and it's got lemonade. It's like it's like drinking candy, folks.
I have a lot of friends that that like that, and I don't like them very much.
You don't like them, or you don't like the friends?
I don't like their choices. I don't like it when their choices interfere with my life.
Well, how does that interfere with your life if they're drinking something you don't like?
Because they're acting like it's so refreshing.
It's quite delicious.
I don't like their enthusiasm. I think that kind of beverage with lemonade breeds too much enthusiasm. It's like a false enthusiasm. I'm not into it.
I'm not enthused by this, but
you're fucking making moaning noises into the mic. That's enthusiasm. You sound like Meg Ryan in When Harry Met Sally.
That's good stuff. Leinenkugel Summer Shandy. Beer with natural lemonade flavor. Leinenkugel Brewing Company, Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin.
I like some of their stuff, though, so I'm not...
They had the beer with the berry stuff that you really were offended by recently.
Well, you have to make beer for a wide audience. You're the berry audience.
It's pop culture moment time, Jason.
Is this about the video game?
I want to talk about a video game, so relax. All right. So, you know, we live in a video game world where everybody plays Call of Duty and Madden and crap, and much of that is total garbage, folks. But, you know, there's a tiny niche gaming series for the PlayStation called Disgaea that I have. It might be my favorite series of games. And it's a niche game. It's not a top of the charts kind of game. And the Disgaea 3 just came out for the Vita. But you can also get it for the PlayStation 3, and you get 1 and 2 for the PlayStation 2, and you get 4 for the 3. But as I play these games more and more, and I love these games, I think to myself, you know who would love these games? Baseball stat dorks. Geeks. Yes, baseball stat dorks would love these games. They are pure dorky games. They are extremely Japanese. Let's start with that. These are incredibly Japanese.
I've used that to describe somebody before.
And I play the game actually with the Japanese soundtrack. But these are, you know, it's anime-style characters. It's a goofy but very well-written story. It's very self-referential and aware of how goofy it is. But the point is, are the kind of the mechanics of the game. The game requires no reaction time or twitch abilities at all. It is a strategy game. You're playing a what is known as an SRPG, a strategy role-playing game. So you are moving various characters around a board and battling other characters and trying to defeat them. But the whole game revolves around statistics. There's 8 million statistics for every one of these things and everything you can do. You're building your characters, speed and attack ability and defense ability, and you're building their weapons so they're better. And there's all these various mechanics that all involve a million different numbers. And as I play these games more, these games, again, have a cult following. It's one of those games where when they come out, everyone who likes them is going to buy them and love them, but they're never going to be a big hit because they're just too weird and too niche. But the whole game, once you get into all the mechanics, and there's a million of these mechanics involved, it's very complicated if you want it to be. It's all about numbers. It's all about numbers and stat management, basically. And it's very, very dorky, revolved around this kind of refreshingly charming anime story.
That sounds incredibly dorky.
I can't tell you how dorky it is. Words can't describe how dorky these games are. However, they're fantastically done. But every time I play them, I go, God, baseball dorks would love these games. They would adore this stuff. It's perfect for them. It requires you to be really anal as far as arranging all your characters and building them the right way and how you use them and everything like that. And it's just filled with numbers and statistics, nonstop numbers and statistics.
So you could get like a lemonade beer and just sit down and just dork out.
Absolutely. For hours and hours on end. It's not a short game. You know, if you buy yourself like an Uncharted game, you might finish that in, 10, 12 hours. You buy a fancy RPG that takes a long time, a lot of story, you buy a Skyrim or something, you could play that forever, 60, 70, 80 hours.
You like that game, right?
The Skyrim? I did like Skyrim very much, which surprised me.
What is that all about? I see people mention it and I just... I turn away because it seems dorky to me.
It's dorky, sure. It's by Bethesda, who made the Fallout games. And the Fallout games are better than the Skyrim games, just to be clear. But it is an open-world role-playing game, first-person, where you are running around. It's very like a medieval sword and sorcery game. But Skyrim works better because it's a Nordic setting.
Oh, okay, so it's not so Japanese.
I tend to hate what are called known as Western RPGs because I don't like the whole kind of European sword and sorcery worlds. I find that incredibly
that's
boring.
Well known that people don't like that.
I have no interest in Game of Thrones and stuff like that. I don't like that shit at all. But this one's like a Nordic setting, so it's like dark and angry, so it works better.
Big Vikings like eating beef and chopping heads off.
Right, exactly. And so, but it's a very open world game where basically you create a character and you're going to run around this huge open world, for lack of a better term, adventuring, completing quests and running around. But it's so open world, you basically, I hate to say there's a story even. Like, the story is going to evolve as you play it, but there's 8 million side stories. It's not going to, there's not, it's completely nonlinear.
I see.
But the Fallout games are much better, which are also similar open-world RPGs, but they take place in a kind of a fake post-apocalyptic world where there was a nuclear war in the 50s. And those
people love dystopian settings.
Right. The Fallout games are incredibly great. These games are just good. But
interesting.
But everyone buys Skyrim because they're done. These are the Bethesda games. They have this long reputation. They're easy to pick up, and the production values and the craftsmanship behind them is kind of stunning. And those are massive hits. Disgaea. Again, niche game, maybe never even heard of them. But, I mean, you can get Disgaea 3 or 4 for the PlayStation 3 right now for probably $15-$20. And I just give them a spin. You might like them, and you might end up dorking out on them like I do.
Well, I won't, but I hope someone does.
And let me know if you do. So, Jason, what do you got going on this week?
What day is it? Today is Thursday, right?
It's Thursday.
Well, I just got back from Wilmington, so I got to bust out. I'm going to actually write an article about, I wrote all the scouting stuff. I'm actually going to write an article about what it was like in Wilmington, because I had this cab driver tell me that he defeated a 357 Magnum using karate. But then he got shot in the gut. So I go, well, it sounds like you didn't win. And then he told me what he did to the guy. I mean, it was crazy. I mean, this guy gave me a 45-minute speech, and it took 10 minutes. It was a 10-minute drive. The bartender at the hotel bar, I was watching the Yankee game while I was having dinner, And he told me
What'd you have for dinner at the hotel there?
it was like a turkey club.
Nice.
It was I just wanted something that wasn't going to make me sick.
Food pill.
Yeah, and he was talking about how, you know, he could play at the minor league level right now, and I had to tell him, I go, look, man, I didn't want to do this, but no. You can't. And I saw a girl who was made of plastic. And so I'm going to write about those things. And then at the end of next week, I'm going to go watch Lakewood and Asheville and Greenville in the Sally League.
That's gonna be fun.
Yeah, for 4 days. So I have another scouting trip coming up, but I'm home all next week.
Excellent.
What about you?
Well, it's Thursday, so I actually have to finish my 12 for 12 piece for ESPN. Every Friday at ESPN, you'll see me write, and it's kind of a ranking of 12 prospects who are advanced, 12 guys who are making noise and making their way to the big league soon to help your favorite big league team and or help your fantasy team. And so I've got that going on. I got to
Like
finish
it.
that. I got to write a call-up piece on Drew Hutchinson, who just got the call from the Blue Jays. It looks like he will be starting for Toronto on Saturday, which actually interests me. And I don't know. I think this might be a little bit of a rush job. I mean, this is a very young kid who's barely pitched at Double A, and but he, at the same time, he's a polished pitcher. So it's gonna be that's gonna be interesting to watch. I'm gonna write about that call-up, and then on Monday I'm gonna go see Francisco Lindor.
Oh yeah.
So
That's my baby.
on Monday, I got myself a day game at Kane County, and I'm going to go see our good friend Francisco Lindor, who is off to a very nice start. But that's not—I mean, that's a good roster. They have Luigi Rodriguez, the leadoff center
You
fielder,
know,
who's
I like him. I like that guy a little bit.
off to a really good start, hitting well over 300 for Lake County. They got. Who else do they got? The catcher Alex Lebiski's there, who is a million-dollar player who showing some signs of life with the bat this year here and there, and then we'll see if that guy can work out. And so there's some talent there, and I get to see Jorge Bonifacio pit some more for King County, so I'm happy about that.
Yeah, I mean,
And
of
other than that,
course.
just rip it out content, get those dailies out every day, and write various other crap.
Well, I mean, you know what? Back to the Lindor thing. What's really great about watching him is that we were just talking about Ronnie Rodriguez and how, you know, some people like him at the position, some people are a little hesitant. What's the great thing about watching Francisco Lindor is that you do not have to question whether he can stay at shortstop.
Right.
It's just, my man.
So, and I don't know if it lines up, but I think I might get Elvis Araujo starting that day.
Oh yeah, I've seen him a bunch. That guy's got some crazy stuff. He hits
Yeah,
real hard.
6'6" left-hander. So,
Bad body.
yes. So we'll both be getting some games. We'll have something to talk about next week, and we'll have a guest next week probably, if I can remember to book somebody this
Let's
time.
get we can get Kendall on to talk baseball and shit. All that guy does is talk shit.
Kendall Rogers from
That's
Perfect,
all he knows how to do is talk shit.
the college guy. We'll have Kendall on to talk some shit in college baseball.
I guarantee he'll offer good information and then he'll just start talking shit about the time he beat me 12-0 in FIFA when my internet froze on the PS3 and I couldn't control my guy. He just kept scoring goals and kept running up the score. It was a Bush maneuver.
There's a lack of class and grace there.
Oh, well, he knows it. He doesn't have it. He doesn't, you know, he's not gonna have it. All he does is talk shit.
Lee's from Texas.
I know. I know, Kendall. I know. He says I'm from Oklahoma, which is a tired comment just because I'm from North Texas. And he went to A&M, so his geography skills are kind of, you know, slack. I'm shooting it out already because when he comes on, I'm just gonna level him with it.
So maybe we'll Texas talk with Kendall and Jason next week.
We'll get an argument and people think we hate each other, and it's just really two Texans pissing on each other. It's
I'll
funny.
just kind of sit back and think about it. And so, but for now, Jason, it's time for the saddest part of the show. And it's time
Yeah.
for you to say goodbye to the internet.
Goodbye to the internet.
And thanks for listening, everyone. We'll talk to you next week in episode 91 as the countdown continues.
To the end.
Ha